Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Desmond Fitzgerald. I'm the Vice President for Research here at UCB. I want to welcome you all onto the campus, particularly those who haven't been here before. And today we note the launch of the Irish Research Group for the Philosophy of Language, which is an all-Ireland initiative. And it's part of a network of excellence that's been established involving many centres across Europe on the philosophy of language. And to mark the occasion, we are delighted to have Professor Noam Chomsky here, Professor Emeritus at MIT, to give a lecture this evening. It's quite extraordinary the interest that's been generated by Professor Chomsky over a series of lectures that he's given in Ireland this week. You can't open the newspaper without seeing a picture of Professor Chomsky. You don't get that publicity in Ireland unless you're attending one of our tribunals, so it's a great credit to him. These lectures have been on, it's fair to say, fairly controversial subjects. He has very strong views on American and British policy in a range of different domains across the world over the last few years. And his views, I think, were shared by many people, and that has resulted in a large crowd attending his lectures this week, three of which have been at UCD. And I'm delighted to see that we have a large crowd again this evening when we have a change of topic. He is a well-known, an outstanding scholar in biolinguistics. And I think that's what he's going to talk about this evening, but we'll just have to wait and see. The title of his lecture is Biolinguistic Explorations, Design, Development, Evolution. Professor Chomsky, we're delighted to have you here this evening.
Within the so-called biolinguistic perspective that began to take shape 50 years ago, this concern is transmuted into an effort to determine the genetic endowment of the faculty of language, that understood as a cognitive organ, in this case virtually shared among humans, and in crucial respects apparently unique to them, hence a species property. The term biolinguistics itself was coined in 1974 as the topic of an international conference that brought together evolutionary biologists, neuroscientists, philosophers, linguists, others concerned with language and biology. It was one of many such initiatives before and since. Well, what I'd like to try to do is say a few words about where I think this enterprise stands today, after about 50 years, keeping mostly to leading ideas, not much in the way of technicality, and straying a bit into some neighboring areas that have for centuries actually been considered closely related to language, had an interesting revival in very recent years, particularly in the domain of moral philosophy. Inquiry into these two domains proceeds along almost parallel paths, almost parallel because they should meet short of infinity, though where is not very clear. One path seeks to understand more about language and mind. The other is concerned, is guided by concerns for freedom and justice. There should be at least some shared elements. These are what the co-founder of modern evolutionary theory, Alfred Russel Wallace, called man's intellectual and moral nature. Those are capacities for creative imagination, language and symbolism generally, interpretation and recording of natural phenomena, intricate social practices, and a complex of capacities that appears to have crystallized fairly recently in evolutionary time among a small group in East Africa from which we are all descendants. Sometimes the complex is simply called the human capacity. The archaeological record suggests that crystallization was quite sudden in evolutionary time, not after about 50,000 years ago, because that's when people, the trek from Africa began and were all more or less identical, and apparently not long too long before what happened in that relatively brief period distinguishes contemporary humans very sharply from other hominids, there were many at the time, and from other animals. It's commonly assumed that the emergence of language was a core element in that sudden change, sometimes called the Great Leap Forward by eminent scientists, because it does appear to have been so sudden. Language happens to be one component of the human capacity that is accessible to study in some depth. The principles of our intellectual and moral nature, in Wallace's terms, they remain a considerable mystery, but we can hardly doubt that they're rooted in our very nature and play a central role in our lives. Well, there's another kind of great leap forward. In the course of the intellectual revolutions from the 17th century, which set the stage for modern science, and also included a cognitive revolution that's a precursor of what is now commonly called the cognitive revolution of the 1950s, which in fact rediscovered themes that had long been forgotten, but that had been developed in thoughtful and instructive ways in the 17th century, from which we still have a lot to learn. One central theme, which in fact was developed by the physician philosopher Juan Huarte in the 16th century, is that, in his words, the essential property of human intelligence is the capacity of the human mind to engender within itself, by its own power, the principles on which knowledge rests. Recognition that the capacity to gain understanding relies on fixed principles of the mind is as old as Plato, but he was only able to suggest that somehow it's remembered from an earlier existence. The 17th century cognitive revolution sought to purge Plato's theory of the error of reminiscence, as Leibniz put it, and that would mean attributing to the mind itself an invariant innate structure. Today, what we would try to formulate in terms of some genetic endowment. Every organism has such an endowment. It enables an animal, including us, to construct experience from some chaotic stimuli, no trivial matter, to construct what ethologists call an Umwelt, a world of experience, differing for us and bees and rabbits and so on, and then to rely, same genetic endowment, to rely on internal principles to develop from this constructed experience our conception of the world in which we live, for us including language, moral codes, and a great deal more. For Cartesian scientists, 17th century, as in fact for Huarte much earlier, the fundamental nature of human intelligence was a kind of creative capacity, which the Cartesians, Descartes himself, his followers, regarded as being exhibited most clearly in the ordinary use of language to express thought. They took that to be the basic distinction between man and beast, man and machine, for the Cartesians. That is the capacity of every person, but no beast or machine, to construct linguistic expressions without bound, free from external stimuli or internal physical states, appropriate to circumstances but not caused by them, which is a fundamental distinction, and eliciting thoughts in others that they could have expressed the same way. They come to understand. Cartesian psychologists developed a series of experimental tests to determine whether another creature has these creative capacities. And their conclusion was that if it passes the strictest tests we can devise, it would be only reasonable to conclude that it has a mind like ours. It's called the problem of other minds in later centuries. Notice that this is a sophisticated and scientifically sound version of what has come to be called the Turing test in recent years. Should add on the side that most of the work on that, in my opinion, is based on a serious misunderstanding of a brief paper of Turing's, so brief that it's hard to misunderstand. These ideas contributed directly to investigation of the nature of concepts, some of them what were called in 17th century common notions, sometimes innate ideas, that are part of our nature, developed or refined through experience. And the ideas also contributed to the investigation of the principles by which linguistic expressions are constructed from common notions. That's a research program that came to be called philosophical grammar, meaning what we would call scientific grammar. David Hume later recognized that knowledge and belief are grounded in what he called a species of natural instincts, part of the springs and origins of our inherent mental nature. He recognized that something similar must be true in the domain of moral judgment, well. The reason he explained is that our moral judgments are unbounded in scope. We constantly apply them in systematic ways to new circumstances, and therefore they too must be founded on general principles that are part of our nature, although beyond what he called our original instincts, namely those narrower instincts that are shared in animals. That should lead directly to efforts to develop something like a grammar of moral judgment. That task was in fact undertaken by the leading American moral and political philosopher of the late 20th century, John Rawls, who relied very explicitly on linguistic models of generative grammar that were being developed in the 1960s at the time when he did his classic work. In the last few years, that has been revived, and it's become quite a lively field of theoretical and by now empirical inquiry as well. It's worth clarifying that these questions can be sensibly raised only if we regard the human capacity as an internal property of people, that is, part of their organic nature. So on a par with their digestive or immune systems, their systems of visual interpretation, organization of motor action, and so on. In other words, as organs of the body, in the loose, informal sense in which the term organ is conventionally used, meaning nothing you can cut out, can't cut the immune system out of the body, but some subcomponent of a complex organic system which has sufficient internal integrity so that it makes sense to study an abstraction from its complex interactions with other systems in the life of the organism. The biolinguistic perspective developed within this framework, taking the faculty of language to be what's sometimes called a mental organ, where the term mental simply refers to certain aspects of the world to be studied in the same way as chemical or optical or electrical other aspects. Now for the Cartesians, as you know, the domain of the mental was distinct from body, the physical world. Now that was a scientific thesis, in fact, a very reasonable scientific thesis. It was based on the very plausible belief that elements of the human capacity, specifically the creative aspect of language use, simply cannot be explained in terms of physical mechanisms. That belief, though very reasonable, was undermined by Isaac Newton in a very unexpected way. Newton did not exercise the ghost in the machine, as commonly said. Rather, he exercised the machine, left the ghost intact and untouched. Newton demonstrated, to the consternation of scientists of his day, including Newton himself, who regarded this as an absurdity for his entire life, true an absurdity, demonstrated that we have no coherent notion of machine, body, physical, material, any of these concepts. We have nothing beyond the best theories of various aspects of the world that we can devise, always looking forward to deeper explanation and perhaps eventual unification, though in unpredictable ways and what have over time turned out to be quite surprising ways. Historians of science have recognized that this intellectual move, which took a long time to settle in, that this intellectual move set forth, I'm now quoting, set forth a new view of science in which the goal is not to seek ultimate explanations, but to find the best theoretical account we can of the phenomenon of experience and experiment. That's Ivernorth Cohen, scholar, leading Newton scholar at Harvard. And in fact, it lowered the expectations for science in a crucial way. Galilean science, Galileo's followers, assumed that the world should be intelligible to us, but Newton demonstrated it's not intelligible to us. We have to lower our sights to trying to discover intelligible theories of whatever the world is. The mind-body problem, in its traditional sense, therefore became unformulable because the notion of the body disappeared, along with matter, physical, etc. Well, all of this was pretty well understood through the 18th and 19th century, and it led to the conclusion that, quoting, properties termed mental reduce somehow to the organical structure of the brain. It's the formulation of the famous chemist philosopher Joseph Priestley in the late 18th century. Though it was well understood at the time, it all seems to have been forgotten. Today we regularly read about the astonishing hypothesis that the mind is the result of the organization of the brain, a bold hypothesis, a radically new idea in philosophy of mind, quoting from highly respected sources. Reiterating formulations of several centuries ago in virtually the same words. It's worth noting that the phrase mind-body problem still exists, but it's now commonly used, though, for a very different problem, which was only very loosely related to the traditional problem. The traditional one was just part of normal science. The new version resurrects some observations of Bertrand Russell's 80 years ago and recently reinvented. Russell asked us to consider a blind physicist who knows all of physics but doesn't know something that we know, namely what it's like to see the color blue. Russell's conclusion was that the natural sciences seek to discover the causal skeleton of the world. Other aspects lie beyond their purview. Well, we can recast Russell's insight in naturalistic terms. We may say that, like all animals, our internal cognitive capacities reflexively provide us with an inbuilt of largely shared experience. But being reflective creatures, thanks to the emergence of the human capacity and the great leap forward, we attempt to go on to gain a deeper understanding of the phenomenon of experience that is created for us by our innate capacities. These exercises have various names. They're called myth, or magic, or philosophy, or science, in the sense of that term that was proposed in the 19th century when philosophy and science diverged. If humans are part of the organic world, we can expect that our capacities of understanding and explanation will have fixed scope and limits. Maybe we're angels, but if we're not angels, that's going to be true. That's a truism which is sometimes derided rather thoughtlessly as mysterianism, but it is a truism. It could be that these innate capacities do not lead beyond some understanding of Russell's causal skeleton of the world, and in fact it's always an open question how much of that can be attained in principle. These, again in principle, could become topics of empirical inquiry into the nature of what we might call a science-forming faculty, another mental organ. These are very interesting topics, but they're not to be confused with the traditional mind-body problem, which evaporated after Newton. The cognitive revolution of the 17th century led to inquiry into the nature of concepts, which has important contemporary implications, which are also, I think, insufficiently appreciated. Going back to the classical period, Aristotle had recognized that the objects to which we refer when we use language cannot be identified by their material substance. For example, he used as a house. He said a house is not merely a collection of bricks and wood, but it's identified in part by its function and design. So it's a place for people to live and store their possessions and so on. In Aristotle's terminology, a house is a combination of matter and form. Notice that his account is metaphysical. He's defining what a house is, not the word or idea house. And that approach did lead to hopeless conundrums. I'm familiar to those of you who've taken philosophy courses. The ship of Theseus is a classic case that should be familiar from your courses, unanswerable. With the cognitive turn of the 17th century, these questions were reframed in terms of operations of the mind, so not what a house is, but what the word house means, and how do we use it to refer. The conundrums disappeared. Plenty of problems, but not conundrums. Well, if we pursue that course, we find, I think, is that for natural language, human language, there is no word-object relation, where so-called objects are mind-independent entities. That becomes, in fact, very clear for Aristotle's example. The word house, when we look at its meaning more closely, turns out to be have complexities and intricacies far beyond what Aristotle supposed. Its form is vastly more intricate. One may be misled by the fact that houses are artifacts. So maybe one might think, well, it's only true for artifacts. But it's not. It's true for everything. So let's consider some simpler cases that were investigated in the 17th and 18th century classics. But take, for example, the word river, which Hobbes considered. Hobbes suggested that rivers are mentally individuated by their origin. And while there's some truth to that observation, it's not really accurate, and it only scratches the surface of our intuitive understanding of the concept. So take, say, the Charles River, which flows by my office, it would remain the very same river if the under quite extreme changes. And so, for example, reversing its course would stop it from being the Charles River. That means that origin can't be the defining characteristic. It would still be the Charles River if it were divided into separate streams that converge in some new place. If any H2O that happens to be in it, probably not too much, were replaced by chemicals from some upstream manufacturing plant, still be the Charles River. On the other hand, under very trivial changes, it would no longer be a river at all. So, for example, if it were directed between fixed boundaries and were used for shipping freight, then it would be a canal, not a river. Or if its surface were hardened by some near undetectable physical change, and a line were painted down the middle of it, and people started using it to drive to Boston, in which case it would be a highway, not a river, even though physically it would be virtually identical. Then on through further intricacies that you can easily determine if you think about it for a few minutes. And in fact, much the same holds for even the simplest concepts, lexical items in linguistic terms. When one explores them, that confirms the conclusion that the world of experience and interpretation is constructed by our rich cognoscitive powers, as they were called in the 17th century, relying on gestalt properties, causal relations, and other mental notions that were in fact explored by 17th century British philosophers and their successors in quite interesting ways. It's still a virgin territory. Summarizing many years of discussion of such topics, David Hume concluded that the identity that we ascribe to minds, vegetables, animal bodies, and other entities is only a fictitious one established by the imagination, not a peculiar nature belonging to this form. His conclusion, I think, is correct. Notice that it's explicitly rejected in the so-called externalist approaches to language and thought that have dominated philosophical discussion of these topics for about 30 years. A notion of particular significance to John Locke and his successors was the notion of person. Locke recognized that persons are individuated crucially by psychic continuity. He concluded that a single body could house two distinct persons if two distinct psychic continuities were connected to it, and a person could persist even if its substance became completely different. Now, those, in fact, are properties of our concepts that are regularly exploited these days by science fiction. These are all properties of the common notion or innate idea of person, which appears to be part of our intrinsic nature and shared across the species without difference. Locke argued further that the term person, unlike, say, tree or cat, is what he called a forensic term, appropriating actions and their merit, belonging only to intelligent agents capable of law and happiness and misery, hence even more remote from the mind-independent physical investigation, and of course at the heart of our moral faculty and intuitions. While these properties of innate ideas are available to very young children, a lot of children's literature, in fact, is based on them, extending to animals as well. The talk was too narrow. So take my grandchildren, who happen to be entranced by the story of a baby donkey named Sylvester. If you read that here, he's turned into a rock by some evil creature, and he spends the rest of the story trying to convince his parents that he's really their baby donkey. Well, children's stories always have happy endings, as you know. So at the end, he's coming back to the baby donkey, and everybody lives happily ever after. Now, the point is that every child understands all the way through, instinctively, in fact, that the rock was really Sylvester all along, doesn't matter what its material constitution was. And there are many such cases. Well, in all such cases, on and on, there is no mind-independent object which could in principle be identified by the physicist, which is related to the name. And as we proceed, we find much more intricate properties that no matter how simple the terms of language we investigate, none escape this, as far as anyone knows. As Hume and others recognize, for human language and human thought, there simply is no meaningful word-object relation, because we do not talk about the world in terms of mind-independent objects. Rather, we focus attention on intricate aspects of the world by resort to our cognoscitive powers. Accordingly, for human language and thought, there is no notion of reference in the technical sense of Frege, Peirce, Tarski, Carnap, Quine, many others, or contemporary philosophical externalists. There can't be books named Word and Object or Word and Thing if they're talking about human thought and language. That fact does not inhibit the act of referring to action. I can tell you that London was bombed last July using the internal resources of my mind to direct your attention to particular aspects of the world, communicating quite successfully insofar as our cognoscitive powers and our relevant experience are shared, or for that matter, I can refer successfully to London by just lamenting an awful tragedy and never using any phrase at all that has any special relation to London. These are normal acts of referring, not requiring some mysterious relation of reference or denotation. Now, these technical concepts are perfectly fine for the purpose for which they were contrived, namely formal systems where the symbols and the objects and the relations are stipulated, so no problem, arithmetic, for example. Arguably, they also provide a norm for science, a normative ideal. It's reasonable to think that the goal of science is to construct systems in which terms really do pick out an identifiable and mind-independent element of the world, like, say, neutron or non-phrase or something like that. But the human language and thought just don't work that way. It can't be put into that framework. Well, if that's true, and the evidence seems overwhelming, then natural language diverges very sharply in these elementary respects from animal communication, which has been held, at least, to rely on, quoting now, a one-to-one relation between mind-brain processes and an aspect of the environment to which these processes adapt the animal's behavior. It's quoting Randy Galastel's introduction to a volume of papers on animal communication, one of the leading specialists on the topic. If so, then one basic problem facing the study of evolution of human language and thought is to account for the emergence of these universal and innate human properties. It's no trivial matter, as you quickly discover when you begin to take words and ideas seriously. Well, when we move beyond the simplest elements of language, problems of this kind escalate very sharply. That was discovered as soon as the long-forgotten tradition began to be revived in the 1950s. And just to give a few of the early illustrations for concreteness, take, say, the sentence, Mary saw the man leaving the bus station. The internal resources that those of us in this hall pretty much share determine that that sentence is three ways ambiguous. They take a moment's reflection to perceive the fact, but if you think about it, they become clear. And furthermore, the same internal resources tell us that the ambiguities are resolved as a single interpretation if we ask, which bus station did Mary see the man leaving? There's a good explanation for that. It relies on computationally plausible principles of minimal search, probably independent of humans, maybe all organisms. And there's plenty of independent evidence for them. Roughly speaking, what appears to be happening is that the phrase, which bus station, in the sentence, Mary saw the man leaving which bus station, now that phrase raises from the position where its semantic role is determined as the object of leaving, and it's reinterpreted as an operator taking scope over a variable in its original position, so that the sentence means roughly something like this, for which X a bus station, Mary saw the man leaving the bus station X, which is its meaning. The variable is silent in the phonetic output, but it must be there for interpretation. In fact, must be there in full, so that the raised phrase is left behind. Now that also is in accord with a very natural principle of efficient computation, sometimes called the no tampering condition, which requires that when an operation applies to certain objects, it leaves them unchanged. That's the minimal possible amount of computation. Only one of the underlying interpretations permits this operation. It's by virtue of the minimal search conditions. I can't go into it, but if you look at it, find that that's true. And that means that the ambiguity is reflexively resolved in the interrogative, assuming that our minds are optimal computational devices, that is, use the most efficient computation possible. And that seems universally true as far as we know. Well, take a second example. Take the sentence, John ate an apple. You can drop an apple that yields John ate, and we understand that to mean that John ate something or other, unspecified. Take the slightly more complex sentence, John was too angry to talk to Bill. You can omit Bill, that yields John was too angry to talk to, which by analogy with John ate, would be expected to mean that John was so angry that he wouldn't talk to someone or other. But that's not what it means. What it means is John is so angry that someone or other won't talk to him, John. In this case, the explanation lies in the fact that too angry to talk to, with the object missing, actually has an operator variable structure based on movement of a, in this case, a phonetically invisible operator, which meets exactly the same conditions as the in the bus station example. Can't explain, that's what it comes down to. In this case, the operator has no content and it's silent. It yields, it's called an open sentence with a free variable, hence a predicate, and that yields instantly the correct interpretation. Again, there's substantial independent evidence supporting the conclusion for a variety of constructions. In fact, these two examples are identical, except that in one case the operator is silent, in the other case it has a phonetic output, bus station. In both cases, the general computational principles, which appear to be universal, and again, probably independent of language or humans, these principles yield the required interpretations as an operator variable construction, with the variable unpronounced in both cases and the operator unpronounced in one case. The surface forms in themselves, the things we hear, tell us very little about the interpretations, and that's a very common situation. The general conclusion, waiting on this, is that even the simplest elements of language find their place somehow in the generative procedures that yield the expressions, but they cannot, in general, be detected in the physical signal. For that reason, it seemed back in the 50s, and it seems today, that the language that's acquired must have the basic properties of an internalized explanatory theory. Now, these are design properties that must be dealt with by an account of the growth of language in the individual, we call it language acquisition, and also in an account of its evolution in the species, in this case alongside the elementary semantic properties of the simplest words. Those are two fundamental problems that have to be dealt with by any account of the evolution of language. Well, quite generally, construction of theories must be guided by what Charles Sanders Peirce a century ago called an abductive principle, something genetically determined, which, as he put it, puts a limit on admissible hypotheses so that the mind is capable of imagining correct theories of some kind and discarding infinitely many others consistent with the evidence. And he was thinking about science creation, but the same is true for language development. For language development, the principles that limit admissible hypotheses must furthermore be highly restrictive. That's just given the facts of the empirical facts of the rapidity of acquisition and convergence among individuals. That much was recognized from the earliest modern work, but the observation confronted what appeared to be impossible barriers. And to see why, you have to look a little more closely at the problems. In the 1950s, when this work began to take shape, the prevailing ideas in both linguistics and general biology adopted a natural interpretation of what may be the most quoted passage in biology, Darwin's concluding words of the first edition of Origin of Species, namely that from so simple a beginning, endless forms most beautiful and wonderful have been and are being evolved. Endless forms was taken literally. A widely held view among evolutionary biologists at the time, and in fact well into the 1980s, was that the variability of organisms is so free as to constitute a near infinitude of particulars which have to be sorted out case by case. That's what the biologists understand about 20 years ago. A similar view was held in the study of language. The belief in this case that languages can differ from each other without limit and in unpredictable ways, so that the study of each language must be approached without any pre-existent scheme of what a language must be. That's theoretical linguist Martin Jost in the 1950s, both expressing very standard views. Well, in neither case, could the formulaic statements be meant literally? That would be incoherent. But they did capture the spirit of prevailing conceptions, which had substantial motivations. Language and languages and organisms do appear on the surface to have virtually endless variety in both biology and linguistics. These basically incoherent assumptions have been gradually shown to be untenable over the years and in somewhat parallel ways, in fact, with some interaction. And there's reason to hope that the analogies and interactions may become more substantive in coming years. I'll come back to that. That's related to the comments I was making about efficient computation. The prevailing conceptions at the time that posed a kind of paradox in both biology and linguistics. For the study of language, the considerations of acquisition entail that the innate pre-existing scheme must be highly restricted so as to limit admissible hypotheses, otherwise acquisition is impossible. But that runs counter to the apparent limitless variety of attainable language. Languages actually get the same paradox in general biology. It's a little less glaring there, but it's still there if you think it through. In the study of language about 25 years ago, efforts to overcome the paradox converge in an approach that seemed to offer a kind of conceptual breakthrough. It's called the principles and parameters approach. It proposed a sharp distinction between processes of acquisition and the format of the internal fixed theory of language. So the basic idea is that the genetic endowment provides a fixed system of principles that, and they're invariant, just genetic endowment, and they interact in the generation of the expressions of a language, and there's also, on the side, a fixed set of parameters of choices that are assigned a value by exposure to external data. So, and then a language will be determined by setting the values and selecting lexical items from a fixed and highly structured store with properties of the kind that I mentioned. Well, the prompt is a promissory note, and that has to be paid by showing that the parameters are simple enough so that they can be set by simple data available to children, and then the fixed principles with parameters set function automatically to yield the rich variety of expressions for every possible human language with their specific interpretations. And that's a huge empirical task, of course, but it's one that's been pursued with some success. It's opened up a very wide range of typologically varied languages to much deeper investigation than ever before. It's identified points of difference. It's completely revitalized the study of language acquisition, which is now an investigation of parameter setting. And it exposed a host of new problems for investigation, sometimes providing answers. If you want to get the flavor of it, there's an outstanding book by one of the leading linguists, which is both accessible and professionally high quality. It's called Atoms of Language by Mark Baker, Rutgers, former student of ours. He concentrates on two languages which are about as different in properties as you can imagine. One of them is English, the other one is Mohawk. They look just every property being different. And what he shows fairly convincingly is that they're identical. If you just change the values of a few parameters in a fixed hierarchic system, which he suggests is universal, it's not going to stand up to future inquiry. Everybody knows that. But it's a long step towards showing what one would like to show sooner or later, that despite appearances, there really is only one language, and they're just mildly different. And in parallel in biology, it's increasingly becoming less absurd to suggest that there really is only one organism, from bacteria to humans, with slight differences, goals to be looked for. The principles and parameters approach largely emerged from intensive study of a range of languages and the paradox that I mentioned. But it was also suggested by an analogy to new developments in biology, specifically the discovery of regulatory mechanisms by François Jacob and Jacques Monod around 1960, and Jacob's account of how slight changes in these mechanisms and their timing and so on can yield great superficial differences. His example, the difference between, say, a butterfly and an elephant. He couldn't actually show it, but he could suggest how it might be true just by shifting the timing of fixed regulatory mechanisms. That model seemed very natural for language as well. Slight changes in parameter settings might yield superficial variety through interaction of invariant principles with parameter choices. This is all the 1970s. The approach also removed a crucial conceptual barrier to the study of evolution of language. In earlier approaches, it appeared that the genetically determined format for language had to be highly articulated, richly structured, specific to language, sharply restricting admissible hypotheses so as to account for the rapidity and the convergence of language acquisition. Well, plainly, the greater the richness and specificity of the format, the harder it will be to account for its evolution. But by divorcing acquisition from the format for language, that conceptual problem disappears. It may still turn out to be that the innate mechanisms are rich and highly structured and specific to language, but that's no longer a conceptual necessity within the principles and parameters framework. Well, once that breakthrough took place, it becomes possible to pursue more seriously the recognition from the earliest days of linguistics, generative grammar, that acquisition of language, I'm not quoting from texts in the 1960s, acquisition of language involves not just a few years of experience and millions of years of evolution yielding the genetic endowment, but it also involves principles of neural organization that may be even more deeply grounded in physical law. It's called aspects of the theory of syntax, for those of you who know that. About the same time, what many biologists are now calling the Evo-Devo revolution was increasingly showing, quoting from technical papers, showing that the rules controlling embryonic development interact with other physical conditions to restrict possible changes of structure and function in evolutionary development, providing architectural constraints that limit adaptive scope and channel evolutionary patterns, excluding Jacob and others. By the 1980s, Evo-Devo discoveries were reviving interest in ideas of what's called rational morphology that predate Darwin, and observations in the early days of modern evolutionary biology that there appear to be predetermined lines of modification that lead natural selection to produce varieties of a limited number in time for every species. It's Thomas Huxley, Darwin's associate and popularizer. These are ideas that had been explored, particularly by D'Arcy Thompson and by Alan Turing, the philosophers and linguists for other work, but this was some of his main work. Actually, Turing had a very radical view of this. His conception, his belief was that sooner or later biology was going to break into two fields. One of them would be in the physics department, that would be the science, and the other would be in the history department. That's the accidental things that happen, one damn thing after another. So, ideas were summarized in an influential so-called consensus paper by Maynard Smith and others 20 years ago, and they've since been considerably extended by discoveries about organizing principles, deep homologies, conservation of fundamental mechanisms of development, going as far back as you can go. Most famous are what are called Hox genes. But by now, such considerations have been induced for a wide range of problems of development and evolution, from things that are simple, like cell division, to optimization of structure and function of cortical networks. In fact, just a few weeks ago, proposals as to how the principles of physics determine that vertebrate brains have a certain distribution of gray and white matter with specific characteristics. Just plain physics being minimal conditions about rapidity of conduction and so on. Well, these discoveries, again, have quite suggestive similarities to ongoing linguistic investigation, in this case, efforts to show that general principles of computational efficiency determine specific properties of the mental organ language. It raises the question of whether or to what extent the linguistic organ is optimally designed to satisfy conditions that it must satisfy to be usable at all. Insofar as that becomes true, language becomes something kind of like a snowflake. It just has to take the intricate form it does because of general principles. Assuming that language has the general properties of other biological systems, we should therefore be seeking three factors that enter into the growth of language in the individual. First is genetic factors. These interpret part of the environment as linguistic experience, which is no trivial matter. nobody understands why my granddaughter interprets part of the environment as linguistic experience, and her pet chimpanzee, songbird, or whatever, it's just chaos. And that's a very hard problem that obviously happens. That's one part of the genetic endowment. Another part of it is to determine the general course of development to the languages attained. In this respect, language is just like everything else. The second factor is experience, which varies somewhat, and it permits variation among languages within a narrow range that gives the superficial impression of a wide variety of languages. And the third factor is principles that are not specific to the faculty of language. Well, that language is a computational system, that's pretty clear. So the third factor is like maybe the only computational system of the kind in the organic universe. The third factor includes principles of efficient computation, which would be expected to be of particular significance for systems such as language, determining the general character of attainable languages. Well, let's go on from there. An elementary fact about language, and a very unusual one in the biological world, is that it's a system of what's called discrete infinity, kind of like the number system. Any such system, just as a matter of logic, is based on a primitive operation that takes objects that are already constructed and constructs from them a new object. It's called recursive enumeration. Call that operation merge. Takes two objects, merges them, makes a new object. Well, either merge or some notational equivalent is a minimal requirement. And if computation is efficient, the no tampering condition will hold, so that if X and Y are merged, we can think of the outcome as simply the set X, Y, with both X and Y unchanged. Well, with merge available, you instantly have an unbounded system of hierarchically structured expressions. For languages to be usable, these expressions have to link to language external but organism internal systems. On the one hand, the systems of thought, on the other hand, the sensory motor system. We can think of each generated expression as a collection of instructions for these systems. That would be instructions for producing and perceiving external signals, and instructions for internal thought, planning, interpretation, organizing actions, for example, the actions of referring to the world from certain perspectives. In tradition, that's a way of restating the traditional familiar observation that a language pairs sound and meaning in some specific way. The expressions that are generated by the language have to satisfy interface conditions determined by the systems with which it interacts. And insofar as these third factor properties function, language will satisfy those conditions in an optimal way, meeting conditions of perfect computation. You can regard an explanation of some linguistic phenomenon as a principled explanation insofar as it derives the phenomenon by efficient computation satisfying interface conditions. And you can construct a very strong assumption, well beyond what anyone believes, but we don't know. The strongest assumption you can formulate, sometimes called the strong minimalist thesis, is that all phenomena of language have a principled account in this sense. That is, language is a perfect solution to interface conditions, the conditions it must satisfy to be usable at all. So it really is a snowflake. Genetic endowment is the residue when this thesis is not satisfied. And an account of the evolution of language will have to deal with the property of unbounded merge and whatever else remains in the genetic endowment after the end of discoveries as to how perfect language is. Well, as a matter of simple logic, there are two kinds of merge, external and internal, they're called. External merge takes two objects, let's say eat and apple, and forms the new object that corresponds to eat apples. Internal merge, which in the literature is sometimes called move, is exactly the same, except that one of the two objects is internal to the other. That's the other logical possibility. So if we apply internal merge to the sentence, say, John saw what, we form the new internal object corresponding to what John saw what. That's meaning no tampering condition. Now, at the semantic interface, both occurrences of what are interpreted. The first is interpreted as an operator. The second is the variable over which it ranges, along the lines that I discussed earlier. At the sensory motor side, however, only one of them is pronounced, namely the first occurrence. You don't say what John saw what, you say what John saw, I wonder what John saw. Well, that illustrates a ubiquitous phenomenon of language called the displacement property. Items are commonly pronounced in one position but interpreted somewhere else. The displacement property has been regarded in the past, by me in particular, as a curious imperfection of language, a departure from good design. But that was an error. The property comes free. Some stipulation would be required to block it, because these are just the two logically possible cases. The structurally highest copy must be pronounced, or there'd be no indication that internal merge is applied at all. Failure to follow to pronounce the other copies follows from third factor considerations of efficient computation, since it reduces the burden of repeated application of the rules that map internal structures to phonetic form. And that turns out to be a very considerable burden when you pay attention to more complex cases. These questions don't arise on the semantic side because there's no such computation. Well, there's more to say, but that's the heart of the matter, it seems. Actually, this simple example, which you don't know what I'll give, suggests that the relation of the internal language to the interfaces is asymmetrical. Optimal design yields the right properties at the semantic side, but it causes processing problems at the sound side. Those of you who are familiar with perceptual models and parsing theory systems and so on will be aware that their major problems are it would be overcome if all of the copies were pronounced, not just the first one. And that if only the first one is pronounced, you've got a lot of gaps you have to locate somewhere. That's the major problem in perceptual parsing theories. And that would be overcome if you just pronounced everything. Well, in this case, efficient computation conflicts with facilitation of communication, and universal languages choose efficient computation. They don't care about facilitation of communication. And that appears to be quite true generally. So it appears that as language evolved and as it's designed, it's an instrument of thought with externalization a secondary process and communication a marginal phenomenon. There are other reasons to believe that something like that is true. One is that externalization appears to be independent of sensory modality. That's been learned in the last 20 years or so from the studies of sign language. The structural properties of sign and spoken language appear to be remarkably similar. The results have been very surprising. Acquisition appears to follow the same course, even babbling. Neural localization appears to be the same, which is pretty surprising again. There are cases by now of children raised in bimodal environments, as they're called, with one parent speaking and the other signing, and such children seem to exhibit no preference at all. They just treat the two languages just as if they were exposed to, say, Spanish and English. That tends to reinforce the conclusion that language is optimized for systems of thought with mode of externalization secondary. Actually, there are more general reasons that suggest the same conclusion virtually as a matter of logic.
the core principle of language, that is, unbounded merge, must have arisen in evolution through some rewiring of the brain, presumably not too long before the great leap forward, meaning very recently in evolutionary time, maybe 60,000 to 70,000 years ago, which is nothing, evolutionary time. Well, whatever took place, some rewiring of the brain, some small mutation, such changes take place in an individual, not in a group, trivially. The individual who was endowed with this rewiring would have had many advantages. So instantly the individual gets the capacities for complex thought, for planning, interpretation, and so on. And that capacity is partially transmitted to offspring. Now that could easily come to dominate a small breeding group of not many generations. Well, at that stage, there would be some advantage to externalization. So the capacity could be linked as a secondary process to the sensory motor system for externalization and interaction, which would include communication, which is a very special case, at least if you invest the term communication with some meaning. It's not easy to imagine an account of human evolution that does not assume this in one or another form. And for sense of that reason, similar proposals were made long ago by eminent evolutionary biologists. So at the International Conference on Biolinguistics 30 years ago that I mentioned, Salvador Luria was the most forceful advocate of the view, I'm quoting him, that communicative needs would not have provided any great selective pressure to produce a system such as language with its crucial relation to development of abstract or productive thinking. And that same idea was taken up a little later by his fellow Nobel laureate, François Jacob, who suggested that the role of language as a communication system between individuals would have come about only secondarily, he added, as some linguists have argued. The quality of language that makes it unique does not seem to be so much its role in communicating directives for action or other common features of animal communication, but rather its role in symbolizing, in evoking cognitive images, in molding our notion of reality, and yielding our capacity for thought and planning through its unique property of allowing infinite combinations of symbols, meaning unbounded merge, and therefore a mental creation of possible worlds. Actually, these ideas trace back to the cognitive revolution of the 17th century, which in many ways foreshadows developments from the 1950s, as we're coming to understand. Well, we can, however, go well beyond the speculation. Investigation of language design can yield evidence on the relation of language to the interfaces. And there is, I think, mounting evidence that the single example that I gave is typical, that language is, that the relation of language to the interfaces is asymmetrical. The language is optimized relative to the thought systems, and it just does the best of a bad job with regard with its relation to the sensory motor systems. Those of you who work in language will know that the apparent enormous complexity of language is mostly in the phonological and morphological systems. We seem to violate every principle of efficient computation you can think of, but more and more it seems true that the syntax and semantics is kind of working like a sort of a snowflake. Well, that's a matter for research, but to the extent that it's true, a principled explanation will reduce to efficient computation and satisfaction of the semantic interface conditions with satisfaction of sensory motor conditions, secondarily communication, just an ancillary process. It's quite the opposite of what's long been speculated, but if you think it through, it's almost necessary that this is the case, and there's by now plenty of evidence for it. Well, at this point, you have to move on to technical discussion, something I can't try here. But I think it's fair to say that there has been considerable progress in moving, just in the past 10 years or so, in moving towards principled explanation in terms of these third factor considerations, that considerably sharpens the question of the specific properties that determine the nature of language. And again, that's been the core problem of theoretical study of language since its origins millennia ago, now taking entirely new forms, rather similar to changes in contemporary biology. Well, the quest for principled explanation faces daunting tasks. We can formulate the goals with reasonable clarity, make some progress. With each step towards the goal, we gain a clearer grasp of the universal properties of language. It should be kept in mind, however, that any such progress, even if you get to the snowflake point, any such progress still leaves unresolved problems that have been raised for hundreds of years. Among these are the question how properties termed mental relate to the organical structure of the brain, the 18th century formulation, and then the mysterious problems of the creative and coherent use of language, a central question of Cartesian science, which is still scarcely even at the horizons of inquiry. Thank you.